the CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, 19 versus Sony, Taylor Swift versus photographers, Sirius XM versus the past, and remembering Amy Winehouse. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, business editor of CMU, except this week, not really, because as you might have noticed, my voice is a little weird sounding, because this week, I am in France!
I'm not. I am in London, so we're trying some difficult technical stuff here. Andy is Skyping into the podcast this week, so if there's any slight blips on his voice, that's not his fault. It's Skype. We're officially blaming Skype for any technical problems.
The internet in France is universally awful.
Because all broadcasters now, that's how they do it. I was down at... I did a bit on the BBC World News last week talking about the festival market, because Glastonbury was starting, and so that was what they wanted to cover. And while I was there, I can't remember what had happened, but they were trying to interview some sports person, and they clearly had a Skype connection, but it just kept going down, and they kept persisting with his interview and keep going. No, he couldn't hear any of that. Keep going. And so you do wonder. But you know, if the BBC can tolerate bad Skype connections, we thought we could make it part of the CMU podcast too. So
yeah, that's they're setting the standard there. Okay, well, so you mentioned Glastonbury. That happened, didn't it?
It did. Glastonbury has happened. It's the one festival that everybody seems to talk about. I mean, whatever you think about the lineup, whatever you think about, you know, how the event has evolved over the years, if there's one festival that dominates the headlines, it is Glastonbury. What were the headlines this year? Kanye set.
Kanye played. That was us all. I weirdly feel like I properly experienced Glastonbury this year, even though being in France, I didn't actually see any of it.
You did, yeah. So you didn't. Not only were you not there, you didn't. Because normally you do actually watch quite a lot of the BBC coverage, don't you?
Yeah, I tried to watch a bit of iPlayer, but they don't let you in France or outside the UK at all.
So you experienced it through social media? Is that how
yes,
you're thinking that you were there?
It was fully Twitter and Facebook. But I feel like I was there.
But what you missed was the highlight of the entire weekend, which of course was the BBC subtitlers' attempts to subtitle Kanye's set.
No, saw that.
Oh, you saw that. because of course Kanye's set has lots of words. The BBC decided to let it run live, so the audio, whereas ITV, when he played the Brits, they had to bleep out all of the... Well, it was the N-word mainly, wasn't it? They let it all through on the BBC, but the subtitle person... Well, you couldn't work out whether they'd been told to sort of, you know, put false letters into the swear words or the offensive words, or whether or not it was just like they couldn't keep up and they couldn't be bothered. Because there was one bit, wasn't there, where it just said... He raps. and it completely gave up trying to translate what it was he was saying. So for me, that was the highlight of the Glastonbury weekend. And of course, if you were there, you missed that. So there's a lesson there. You don't need to go to Glastonbury. Your message is go to France and watch
go
it.
Go to France. Don't watch any of it. It'll all be fine.
On the social networks.
It's good. My sister was there. She was doing the Independence live blog.
That's right.
That's partly why I saw quite a lot of it, because I was reading what she was writing.
So we're not going to talk any more about Glastonbury today, but if you go and Google Independent Glastonbury live blog, you can read Andy's sister's first-hand account and know everything
yes.
that you need to know. Of course, the other big thing that happened this week, which we're not really going to talk about because we're sick to death of talking about it, is Apple Music finally went live. But with that... As Zane Lowe keeps trying to remind us, Beats One is a worldwide radio station. So you have been experiencing that.
Yes, I can confirm that you can get that in France. I listened to the first hour and a half of Zane Lowe before, you know, I think I had to go in a swimming pool or something. But I heard all that, Zane Lowe shouting and that.
Andy said he was on holiday, but actually we sent him to France just to check that
the main reason
Beats One
I'm here.
Was there. And still broadcasting sort of 24 hours a day in France, as it is here in the UK, although really, I think it's 12 hours a day on a loop, isn't it? Is that what's
yeah,
happening?
Yeah, it's not really. I mean, as much as they say, oh, it's a 24-hour radio station, it's a 12-hour radio station. And then repeats itself.
They keep going on about the fact that it's all day, all the time, as if that's unusual. Isn't every radio station these days 24 hours a day? I'm pretty sure that was something that radio stations used to brag about in the 80s, you know, because prior to that, radio wasn't 24 hours a day. It went 24 hours a day. That's what everyone talked about in the 80s. The fact that in 2015, that's your selling point. But anyway, we agreed we weren't going to talk about Apple Music. Because we're
so let's talk
death.
About something else.
So let's
what
talk about
talk
something
about?
Else. Well, we should start off with what... Well, actually, this did not get much coverage. But this ongoing legal squabble between 19 Entertainment and Sony Music, if this gets to court, it probably won't. But if this gets to court, it will be such an interesting case. And 19 Entertainment added a whole extra layer to the litigation just last week. So it's interesting.
We like layers. There's already quite a lot of layers.
There are. So, hey, Andy.
I just want to skip back.
Remind us who 19 Entertainment are.
19 Entertainment, the company that was set up by Simon Fuller, who was the man behind such institutions as the Spice Girls and the Pop Idol franchise, which obviously led on to X Factor, S Club 7, and in the US, American Idol.
Yes, so that was 19 was the company that set up American Idol. Fuller then sold the company, so he's no longer involved. It's now owned by some, I think ultimately some private equity fund owns what is left of the company. But there is still a management business within that. And if you remember back in the day when you mentioned that he managed the Spice Girls and he was behind S Club, but he was also behind these TV shows, Pop Idol and American Idol. And through Idol, he put the two businesses together. So he owned the concept and ran the show. But then finalists on the show would then be managed by his company. So he picks up the management contracts on most of the American Idol finalists and the winners. Obviously, American Idol's been going a very long time now, so he's not still managing all of them, but he is still managing quite a lot of them. I say he, his company is. 19 is still representing, in management terms, quite a lot of the former American Idols. Most of those early Idols are signed to Sony Music, because back in the original days of American Idol, if you were a winner or a finalist, you got managed by 19 as part of the deal, but then you won. Your prize was a record contract with Sony, as indeed is still the case with the X Factor, given Simon Cowell's involvement. So you have a bunch of former American Idols who are managed by 19 over here, assigned to Sony over here. That's all been ticking along nicely for years. But now, with Fuller out of the picture, the guys at 19 have suddenly decided they've got some fundamental problems with the contracts between their clients and Sony Music. And so this all went legal, I think it was last year. Was it last year?
Yeah, it's been running for quite a long time now, and there's been various lawsuits filed over that time covering quite a lot of things. I mean, the fees charged by Sony as it moves money around different companies within the group. What happened to the cash from the LimeWire settlement in that case?
If you remember the LimeWire settlement.
If you can, does anyone remember that? It was all a long time ago now. The classic, whether iTunes income is a sale or a license, that's a big question. But this week, they've updated it with the other classic of the day, which is what is happening to the equity that Sony and the other majors own in Spotify. And I think their particular gripe is that they're suggesting that Sony and the other majors took equity in Spotify and then lower royalty payments, because obviously they have to pay royalty payments over to artists, and the equity they own, they don't. It just seems like they kind of, every now and then they go, oh, there's another thing come up. We'll just add that.
Yeah, as you say, there's a big long list of things in this litigation, and the list keeps getting longer. And actually, it's increasingly reading like the list of classic gripes that you'll find big name artists have with their labels. And if you ever talk to managers of artists who have sort of long standing relationships with record companies, particularly if they're sort of legacy artists, so they're no longer working with the label on new content, but they're still due royalties from records that they released a few years ago, all of the things that are in these lawsuits often come up. What happens to the money as it moves around a big music company? That big digital thing, the difference between license and sale. And that stems from the fact that a classic record contract provides to pay royalties to artists. So you sign a record deal, you normally give away the copyrights in your sound recording. The label is then obliged to pay you a cut of any money that comes in. But usually the percentages are different depending on how the money is earned. And the big distinction is between a sale and a license. So what that sort of meant in the olden days was, if we sell a CD, then we get to keep most of the money and we'll pay you probably about 15%. This is a major label deal. But if we make money by syncing something to an advert, we'll split the money 50-50. And a traditional record contract would make that distinction. The big question is, well, what about digital? Is a download a sale, like a CD, or a license, like a sync? Well, technically, it's a license. The record companies do a licensing deal with companies like Apple to enable iTunes. And so there's been this squabble about, well, why aren't you therefore paying us the 50% higher royalty when the vast majority of record companies are paying their artists the lower 15% or whatever it is on download income? This has been subject of numerous lawsuits over the years, most of which have been sadly settled out of court.
Yeah.
There were a couple of class actions, but I mean, even so, they've not been settled in any dramatic way. But I think think what's interesting about this lawsuit is most of the disputes on this to date have predominantly focused on downloads. So even though everyone's settling on this now, it's sort of like, well, actually, that's becoming irrelevant anyway, because we all know downloads are in decline. What about streaming? And the case for streams being a license rather a sale, arguably, it's a stronger argument. And this case, if it got to court, would sort of reignite the entire digital royalties debate, but focusing on the streams rather than the downloads, which would make it very interesting. And that's before you get, as you say, to the extra little line that they've added in the last 7 days, which is this debate over what happens when a major record company takes equity in a Spotify, and how are we, the artists, sharing in that? And as you said, it's this conspiracy theory that the reason, when you take equity, when you do a deal with a new streaming service and they give you 5% of the company or whatever it is, in return for that, you give them slightly better per play rates. And it's the per play rate that the artist shares in. So that the 19 are saying, our artists are earning less from streaming because you accepted less preferential on play rates from a Spotify type service in return for the equity. And you're sort of playing the system. That equity is another big bugbear of the artist community. And if and when Spotify floats, and most people seem to think that they will still float at some point in the next 18 months, that's going to be a big issue that all the artists are going to shout about. And so it's interesting to see it being added to a bit of litigation that could get to court, you know, before the Spotify flotation happens.
Yes. So, yes, 19 of... accuse them of acting wrongfully and in bad faith to divert money from royalties that must be shared to other forms of revenue that they can keep for themselves. So, yes, that's the line, basically, that's been added.
And it's interesting that although this litigation only involves Sony, because all of the artists that 19 represents in this scenario are signed to Sony Music, the lawsuit does say this isn't just Sony. And
Sony and the other major record labels.
Yeah.
It's calling them all out.
So it is trying to get the wider debate going. So as I say, my gut instinct on this is that it's not going to go to court. But if it does, just the fact it has all of these different gripes that artists and managers have had with labels over the years, and that equity issue that, I mean, I can't remember if we talked about this on the podcast. The issue around unallocated advances was big news about a month, 6 weeks ago, after that Spotify-Sony contract leaked. And what we found out was that Sony got massive advances off Spotify when they did their original deals in the US. And if those advances hadn't been recouped by Spotify within the first year, then Sony gets to keep the difference. So Sony could well be sitting on, you know, £1 million or $1 million of an advance that it received, but was never then allocated to specific streams. And then the question is, well, what do you do with that money? Do you share it with your artists? Suspicion was that they didn't.
All the majors have now said that they do.
Exactly.
There's still a question over when they started doing that
and what it means. But both Sony and Universal were very quick to come to the table and say, no, we are sharing those unallocated advances, or breakage, as it's sometimes called. We knew Warner were already doing it, so kudos to Warner. But they're all now claiming that they're sharing the advances, but nobody nowhere is talking about that equity and what will happen if and when Spotify floats and the majors suddenly make a lot of money on one day by selling all of their shares. So as I say, it's interesting to see it being added to this litigation. And if it gets to court, the guys representing 19, the lawyer who are representing 19 in this, is the same lawyer who represented the Marvin Gaye family in their dispute over the blurred lines plagiarism.
Which would suggest that Sony has an interest in not letting this get to court.
And he's quite a character. He's quite outspoken. This will almost certainly be settled. But hey, let's just pretend that it won't be. and that's something to look forward to if and when it reaches court and all of this sort of falls apart and gets dissected. So, 19 versus Sony, not getting as much coverage as Apple Music this week, but definitely one to keep an eye on.
So on to a story that we covered as an aside last week, but actually now it's a whole main story. This is how the media works. And this involves the media, interestingly, in that we discussed last week that after Taylor Swift called out Apple for not paying royalties on the free trial period of Apple Music, she wrote a letter, or she wrote a blog post on Tumblr, and then Apple rolled over and went, oh, right, you can have some money.
And then everyone saying, yay, Taylor, for standing up for the little
Taylor,
guys, for the creators.
Everyone was cheering in the streets, except photographers, or one specific photographer, Jason Sheldon, who wrote his own open letter, who said, well, that's nice that you're apparently cheering for the little guy and making sure everyone gets paid, but what about this agreement you make photographers sign before they can photograph your live shows, which basically says you're, well, not that you can't earn money from this, but you're going to have a lot of trouble earning as much money as you would usually expect to from any photographs you take.
Now, last week when we talked about this, you were very generous to Taylor Swift, and you were saying, okay, you know, perhaps these contracts aren't entirely reasonable, these agreements that pop stars make photographers sign when they go into a gig venue to take photos. And it says things like, you can only use the photos that you take for the publication that has specifically sent you here this evening. You can't then sell them on to other publications. You can't keep using them. And actually, we, as in Taylor Swift, can use your photos, you know, forever for whatever they want, without having to pay you any money. But you were sort of saying that we have heard other artists making these demands, and that it's not just Taylor Swift. But what's happened this week is that somebody has started to say, while that is true, Taylor Swift's contract is the most draconian of them all.
Well, it's interesting that this is not. I mean, other photographers have come out. I mean, every photographer who has come out has said there's a lot of other people who don't like this, but they're scared that if they call out, you know, if they come out against it, they'll get blacklisted and they won't be able to take any photos at all from anywhere, and then, you know, then all their money's gone. But in this case, it's the Irish Times who have called out Taylor Swift and said that she played two shows in Dublin earlier this week, and at the Three Arena, and the Irish Times ran no pictures of that show and published an article explaining why, in which they said that the reason there were no pictures was because the agreement they were asked to sign, or their photographers were asked to sign, made it impossible for, you know, impossible for anyone to earn any money off it. And it was sort of, it was ridiculous. It noted that these agreements are increasingly common, but sort of suggested that hers was worse than others they've seen, saying that, you know, it had various restrictions, such as the one-time only use on publishing a photograph that then apparently elapsed at the end of the year, so you had to publish it within a set time period as well, and then after that point you had to get written consent from Taylor Swift or her people to use those photographs again. That was the defense that Taylor Swift people used last week, saying it doesn't stop photographers from reusing these photographs. It does nothing of the sort. That's nonsense. It's been totally misrepresented. But if you have to go to them and ask for permission to use your own photographs, it does put, you know, a heavy restriction on the photograph again.
And it's interesting that this was a publication rather than a freelance photographer sort of complaining this time. So it wasn't a freelancer saying, I can't make any money on my photos. It was the picture editor of the Irish Times saying, this is a massive pain for us as a publication too. And I suppose at this point, I mean, you say Taylor Swift people were like, well, you can always come and ask us for permission. But that sort of ignores the way that news media works. It's not that, you know, news media are like, oh, we're going to need a Taylor Swift photo in 2.5 weeks' time. We must remember to send an email to her people. You know, the way newspapers work is, you know, one afternoon it'll be like, oh, we really need a picture of Taylor Swift. What have we got on file? Oh, we pay for that photograph to be taken. We have the rights to use that photo. We'll plonk it on the page. And for, you know, the idea of the publication would have the time to be going, oh, who are Taylor Swift's representatives again? Oh, we'll send them a nice little email. It's just unworkable.
Well, and to have the context for everyone you'd ever need to contact to get permission on these things.
Well, I suppose, yeah, it is. What precedent do we set? Even if we tolerate it because Taylor Swift is the biggest pop star of 2015, if everybody starts demanding this, it just makes using photos unworkable. And it's sort of mad in an age where there are so many photos of artists, you know, just taken by fans or whatever, sort of, you know, flooding around the internet, that with this one element. Because we did say last week, didn't we, was this more about creative control than wanting copyright, commercial control?
Well, there's obviously, I mean, although these sorts of agreements predate this, I think it's probably stepped up since there was that BuzzFeed article with all those Beyoncé photos that Beyoncé decided were unflattering and got very angry about. And I think it's probably controlling photographs like that appearing, you know, repeatedly in different places.
But it's still, I suppose, from the media's perspective, it's sort of unworkable. I mean, as far as I'm aware, Swift's people, as you say, after Jason Sheldon, put out his original blog post, the Taylor Swift people did respond and said everything that you said they said. As far as I'm aware, they haven't specifically responded to this request. And it'll be interesting to see.
But I am on holiday.
You are on holiday.
The Irish Times deputy picture editor, Brenda Fitzsimmons, said in this article that the Irish Times published, the terms and conditions of the contract are exceedingly restrictive and just not feasible for a working newspaper and website, which is basically what you just said. Like, you can't be, you know, the things move quickly in the news, in the media. You can't be getting permission for everything, especially, you know, if you've had photographs taken so that you can use them.
So it'll be interesting to see if Taylor Swift's people, A, publicly respond to this, and B, even if they don't, whether or not there will be a relaxation of these, or you know, if enough publications stand up, enough photographers stand up and start saying that we just won't sign these, it will. I mean, if one publication's doing it, then certainly for a big name pop star, they'll just be like, well, don't come and take photos of us. But if everybody, if all photographers and all publications start doing it, well, actually, even big pop stars want photographers in the front row because they all want to be, you know, on page 5 of Metro, so everybody knows they're in town, everyone knows they're out promoting stuff. So I think it probably is a battle that the photographers can win, providing all the photographers and all the publications stand up. And it was interesting to see the Irish Times leading on that this week.
Yes, it would be. Yeah, it would be interesting to see if any others follow suit.
So let's have a rally call for all the photographers out there. You know, we're meant.
Well,
to
let's
be...
do it. I mean, we don't commission photographers.
No, we don't.
I'll say it now. CMU will not stand for this.
Yes, and I know some photographers, and they're all very annoyed about their copyrights being trampled in the internet age. So let's stand up for the photographers, and you should all stop taking photos of pop stars, and see if we can get this one changed. It will be interesting to see how Ms. Swift responds. OK, it's that time in the podcast each week where I ask Andy Malt to justify the songs, the artists, the videos, the tracks that he has been approving in the CMU-approved slot in the CMU Daily over the last 7 days. It's worth mentioning that Andy wrote all of these before he went away on holiday, because we don't make him submit his approveds while he's away. We make him stay really late the night before he goes and have to write all of them. We stand over his desk and we don't let him leave the building until he has approved enough artists for the entirety of his holiday. I don't know why you bother going on holiday. It would be easier.
Well, because I need a rest after all that extra work.
But this is what you've been approving this week, so see if you can remember why it was that you picked them. So first of all, we had Alex Lamani. That's how I'm saying it. I don't care how you say it.
That's an interesting pronunciation. I think it was right. It was just very slow. Alex Lamani is a Congolese rapper who has a new EP out this week. Trouble Anxieux, whatever, it's French. He raps in French.
Well, you should know.
Although I have been speaking French here.
Have you?
It's mainly
mainly asking the way to
related.
The bus.
It's not... anxiousness related, but this track is Oli Benga, who is a CMU approved producer in his own right and also bassist for Metronomy, and it's a dark track. It's not actually, I think Alex Lamani's other stuff is probably a little bit kind of lighter tone than this track, but it's really good, and Oli Benga's production really matches the kind of dark mood of the whole track.
I think we've got edited highlights there because I have a suspicion that Skype lost a couple of the key adjectives, but I think we understood enough, and I'm going to go straight on to Philco Fiction and get you to explain what you're approving there.
Philco Fiction, who have appeared several times in the CMU column because they are good. They're from Norway. They used to be a trio, now apparently a duo, I think they are preparing to release a new album this year. I haven't actually heard of any details on it, but why else would they be releasing new singles? This one's called June 17th. It appeared online on June 17th, but, you know...
It took us a while to notice.
We just discussed the media moving very quickly. Apparently the media moves very slowly in some cases, so it's come out a little bit later than that. But it's a great pop track, as are many of their tracks.
I'm going to let you introduce the next one.
Suiyobi no Campanella.
Yeah, them.
That means Wednesday's Bell.
And even though that sounded quite French the way you said it, these are a Japanese outfit.
Yeah, although campanella, that's an Italian word.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, they're mixing it up. But yes, Wednesday's Bell, if you want to put it in English, translate both languages. They're quite prolific on YouTube. It's unusual for a Japanese act where they generally aren't prolific on YouTube at all and don't generally put up full tracks. They're a kind of pop rap act. A new track that's just come out called Shakushine. Which that is not how you pronounce that. Never mind, I'm not going back to it. And this is probably one of their best tracks to date, actually, of the many they've released over the last few years. I mean, it's a really interesting project. Nice to see an act like this break Japan. I think Japanese pop rap is probably quite a hard sell, but it's one I'm going to keep plugging at with them and charisma.com, who I've also approved in the past.
I know you said that when you first stumbled across their music, and not all their tracks are that accessible from Point Zero, but this was actually a good way of introducing yourselves to what these guys do.
That is correct, yes.
Finally,
final one, come on.
I like this one. It was the track Batteries from Batteries, coming from the album Batteries.
Yes, they do have other tracks that are not called Batteries, although that's slightly disappointing, really. This is Stephen Clark, who you might know as Sci-Fi Stephen from... this is actually his first solo album, and it's a really kind of, it's punkier than Biss. It's very kind of new wave, but still has that, you know, indie pop element that Biss are known for. It's maybe a bit Devo, and it's quite humorous. I mean, the whole album is quite funny, but still, you know, not funny in the way that you'd only want to listen to it once. It's definitely a keeper. I'm enjoying the album very much.
And the album is out in August.
So it is.
There you go. Those are the four tracks approved this week. Just on the off chance that Skype deleted any key words from Andy's description,
I
suggest
probably
that you go to completemusicupdate.com/approved, where you can read the full little tip pieces that Andy wrote, and indeed listen or watch the tracks/videos for yourself.
Okay, next story, and we're really sticking with the media again. It's quite a media-heavy edition, really, this week. The SiriusXM, which is a satellite radio station in the US and North America, it's in Canada as well, has reached a settlement with the major labels and the label that represents the early Rolling Stones catalogue on pre-1972 royalties, which is, I don't know if we've discussed this on the podcast yet, so it's probably time we went into some depth on this quite ludicrous technicality.
Okay, are you ready for the depth? I'm going to have attempt the depth on this. So yes, the year 1972 is an important year in American copyright law, because it was in 1972 that we first got federal copyright law protection of sound recordings in the USA. So federal law obviously means US-wide, rather than the laws that exist state by state at a state level. So prior to 1972, sound recordings were protected by state copyright law in the US rather than federal copyright law. The reason why that's important is it means that any rules that sit in federal copyright law only apply back to 1972. And this has become a really important issue when it comes to online and digital royalties. So the other thing you need to know about American copyright law, federal copyright law, that is that unlike here in Europe, where there is a general performing right for sound recordings, just like there is for songs, in the US, there is only a performing right if recordings are communicated and performed through a digital or satellite channel. So to try and explain what the hell I meant by that. So over here in Europe, if you play a recording in a public space, like in a club venue, or you have a recording going out on the radio, then you need to have permission from the record company in order to do that, and you have to pay some money. You would pay it in the UK through the collective licensing system. So you would pay some money to PPL, and they would split the money, and they'd give some to the artist, and they'd give some to the record company. And that applies to any public performance of a sound recording. That includes broadcast, it includes TV, it includes radio here in the UK, and actually in most other countries around the world. In the US, that doesn't apply. Okay, so if you're an AM or an FM radio station and you play a record over there, you still have to get permission and pay money to the people who own the copyright in the song. So the publisher and the songwriter get some money, again, through the collective licensing system. But AM, FM radio stations and club venues, etc., pay nothing to record companies in the US. And the reason for that is back when they were writing that federal copyright law in the late 60s and very early 70s, the radio station said, well, when we play your records, we basically promote your new releases. You should be paying us. Indeed, some labels were. So why should we be paying you? And so it was written that way. And the record industry doesn't like it, and they've been trying to get the law changed to bring US law in line with European law for a long time now, but they haven't succeeded. Except when satellite and online radio came along in the 90s, they managed to get a line added to American federal copyright law that said, OK, when it comes to online radio and satellite radio, you guys, you do need a license from the record industry. You do need to pay royalties. Although there is what we call a compulsory license. So the labels are obliged to license these services through the sound exchange system. So it's not that the record companies can tell Sirius or Pandora, and those sorts of services are covered by this too. The labels can't say to those services, no, you can't use our music. But they are due some money, and the money normally comes in through sound exchange. So Sirius and Pandora, etc., they, unlike AM and FM radio in the US, are paying money to the record companies, and that's all great. Except that Sirius said, well, hang on a second, on some of our channels, we play music from the 1950s and the 1960s. And that it predates 1972. And therefore, this rule that online and satellite radio stations have to pay royalties, it's federal law, so it can only possibly extend back to 1972. So whenever we play music from the 50s or the 60s, we're not going to pay the record industry or the artists any money. We're not going to pay Sound Exchange any money because we don't think that we owe any money. AM/FM radio stations playing 50s and 60s music, they're not paying royalties to the record companies or the artists. There is no distinction between traditional and satellite radio under state law, so therefore, we don't have to pay. And so that has been the position of Sirius and indeed Pandora and some other services operating online under a similar license for some time now. But of course, the good old record industry begged to differ. And they said, no, 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 you do owe us royalties pre-1972. And actually, although what's happened this week involves the trade body for the US record industry, the Recording Industry Association of America, always catchy, always easy to say. It's actually two artists who have mainly been leading on this so far. Most of the big cases that we've seen in court have been led by Flo and Eddie. Remind us who Flo and Eddie are.
They, I'm not sure it's going to help. They, in the 60s, were known as the Turtles, or they were part of the band The Turtles.
You saying that the average See Me podcast listener has never heard of The Turtle. Happy Together is their hit, isn't it? Isn't that their sort of their big hit?
Isn't it?
They had songs.
We've covered it before, but you know that I'm still trying to get my head around how this whole technicality can really even exist. So remembering the names of their songs is a starter.
You have got the capacity in your brain to cope with that.
There's not room in my brain.
In addition to all of the American copyright law that we're trying to explain. So it was Flo and Eddie who took this case to court first because they were suing under state law. So the argument is, okay, federal law doesn't extend back beyond 1972, but we, Flo and Eddie, and the record labels, and for that matter Sound Exchange, we think that royalties are due under state law as well as federal law. And so what that meant was Flo and Eddie had to sue not at a federal level, but at a state level. And they sued in California, I think they also sued in New York, and I think they also sued in Florida. They sued in three different states, but it's the Californian case, really, that's been most important. And initially, Sirius, I think, thought they were completely on a winner here because, well, AM and FM stations aren't paying on state-protected sound recordings. Federal law doesn't apply. Clearly, we shouldn't have to pay. And then it went to court last year in California, and the judge there made a ruling which sort of surprised, but certainly surprised Sirius, which was, no, actually, you are due to pay money under Californian copyright law because we reckon that there is a general performing right for sound recordings prior to 1972 under state law. So just like there is over here in Europe, there is a performing right for sound recordings. Actually, state law is a little bit ambiguous about that. It doesn't explicitly say there is a performing right, but it doesn't say that there isn't a performing right. And so the Californian judge said, so I think there is a performing right and there is no distinction here between satellite and AM/FM, but it doesn't matter. You are due to pay some money. When the same matter came up in the New York court relating to the different cases there, Sirius raised the question, well, hang on a second. If you're saying there's a general performing right under state copyright law in the US, in California and probably in New York too, well, that would apply to AM and FM radio. Because what you're saying is that the fact that it doesn't specifically mention online and satellite radio in state law doesn't matter because actually there is a general performing right for sound recordings at a state level, just like there is in Europe. So why aren't AM and FM radio stations paying this money? More to the point, why have the labels never asked AM and FM radio stations to pay the royalties? And the judge in New York said, just because the labels have never enforced this right, which might seem mad. That's not what the judge said. That's my opinion.
Especially if it's something they want to do.
Yeah, given that they've been desperately trying to get radio royalties. But just because they've never done it doesn't mean that the right doesn't exist. So basically, this has been totally swinging in the record industry's favour in the last 12 months. There are various different cases around the US on it. And what happened this week was that the Sirius reached a settlement with the RIAA, which represents the major record companies in the US, and, as you mentioned, that smaller record company that represents various older catalogues of music, but most notably the early Rolling Stones catalogue. So them, Universal, Sony and Warner, they reached this deal. It was a big chunk of money. What was it?
It's $210 million on all recordings made before 1972 that they're playing, which I presume is for to cover past plays. And then they've also signed a licensing deal to use the recordings until the end of 2017.
Yes, and I'm not sure whether the $210 million is just for past playing of 60s and 50s repertoire, or whether it also is some advance payments up to the end of 2017, or whether there's more payments to come. Not entirely clear on that front.
But it will be the deal will then be renegotiated at the end of that period. So it's not that, you know, they're only going to do it for a time. It's this is how it is now.
So it's interesting to know all sorts of other questions, which is, well, what about the independent labels? And although probably the majors dominate and control most of the 50s and 60s catalogue, there is still, you know, a certain portion which is represented by independents who are not part of this settlement.
Yes, obviously there were fewer independents in those decades, but they still existed.
And I suppose a lot of those that did exist were subsequently bought up by majors.
But yes,
there is still indie label represented catalogue. There's also some other questions, which is, OK, if Sirius have now admitted that they have to start paying royalties on the 50s and 60s catalogue, are they going to pay that direct to the label, or are they going to pay it through the sound exchange system that exists on the 72 plus catalogue? And if they don't pay it through the sound exchange system, well, that poses an interesting question for artists, because when money goes through sound exchange, it gets split, and half of it gets paid to the label, but 50% of it gets paid directly to artists, in much the same way as happens with public performance income over here in Europe through things like PPL in the UK. So if the money's going direct to the majors, well, how are the artists getting their cut? Because had the money gone through sound exchange, the artists would have been getting an automatic 50% cut, oblivious of contract, it goes to the session musicians too. So that all has to be settled out. And the Flo and Eddie cases are still working their way through the courts, so it'll be interesting to find out if Sirius won on appeal on the Flo and Eddie case, but now they've already done this agreement over here with the RIA. And one assumes that Sirius have decided that they're not going to win this, and they might as well bite the bullet, write a check, and try and have the whole thing sort of kicked out of the place. But it's an interesting settlement, and it also poses the question: well, what about those AM and FM stations? If this is basically,
yeah, I mean, it would seem to put the labels in a better position on that side of it as well.
Yeah, or why aren't they going after the traditional radio stations? I mean, we know that the record industry is lobbying in Washington to have a general performing right added at a US-wide level, which may or may not happen. The radio lobby is very strong in the US. But if they can't get it added to federal law, well, there is still now a case using all the precedent here to then go after sort of the iHeart medias of this world to get money for the golden oldies stuff. And to an extent, radio stations still say in America, we shouldn't have to pay because we're promoting your music. But it has to be said, if you're only playing 50s and 60s music, what are you promoting?
Yeah, it's not like, yeah, giving a leg up to the new guys on the block. Not like those guys from the 20s. They deserve a bit of money.
So it will be interesting to see various questions raised by this, but quite a big movement on the front of a very long-running bit of legal squabbling based on a really peculiar element, two peculiar elements, maybe three peculiar elements of the specifics of American copyright law.
The whole thing's peculiar. American copyright law in general is it's just peculiar. None of it makes any sense.
And when I do all my music rights training courses, or when I speak at conferences on music rights, it does seem like you often say, I mean, copyright varies from country to country. Every country has a different copyright system. But it does seem to be that you frequently say, it basically works like this around the entire world, Oh, apart from in America. And America is all totally different. But who knows? Perhaps America will fall in line on this in general with Europe. But in the meantime, well, $210 million for the majors. So let's all go round to Sony's offices for a big party. That's what I say.
See if 19 Entertainment adds that to their lawsuit.
Yes. Where's my share of that money?
Everything else is on there. They might as well do that.
We'll probably be back next week talking about that very development.
Before we get to our last story, we just have time to run through the things we didn't have time to talk about this week, starting with Facebook talking to the majors about a music service.
This is possibly something we should have spent more time talking about, except as far as we can see, Facebook have been to see Sony, Universal and Warner and said, we want to do a music service within Facebook, and the majors have said, what would that look like? And Facebook have said, we've no idea.
But we want to do it. I mean, it worked for MySpace.
So very early days, but rumour has it that Facebook is considering, finally, people have been speculating about this for as long as Facebook has existed, finally perhaps Facebook is going to move in the music space. Or it may simply be, obviously Facebook have really expanded their video content, allowing people to upload videos, and it starts to get like YouTube. Well, are people uploading music content? Is Facebook licensed to stream it? So it may be to cover their backs on things like that.
Mega Upload execs are fighting to get their assets back.
Yes,
again.
The Mega Upload story continues to rumble on. Earlier this year,
we've stopped reporting on this story quite so much because little things keep happening. But this is all just to bring you up to speed. No one has been extradited.
Yes, and as you say, there were so many little developments on this. Yet actually, nothing seems to have happened for about 4 years now. So,
Kim.com still wants his stuff back.
And who can blame him? That's what I say.
A French tech magazine was fined for publishing a guide to file sharing.
This
Who
is actually
could have guessed?
A very interesting story, that this magazine in France was basically telling its readers, this is how you can still get a load of free music and movie content online. And the record industry trade body in France sued them, saying actually that violates copyright law to sort of suggest to readers that they should go and pirate.
It wasn't just a little feature, it was their cover story.
It was a massive thing, basically saying just Google free content and it's all there for you. So an interesting development in France.
Kilimanjaro has launched its own ticketing site because, hey, everyone else has.
Yep, Kilimanjaro, both gig and festival promoters, they are now part, they're linked to a German live music company, and basically the parent company launched a ticketing site in Germany earlier this year, I think, maybe late last year, and now they've launched one here in the UK.
15% of UK web users are blocking ads.
That's according to the Internet Advertising Bureau, who did a bit
taking
of research.
Taking the bread and butter out of my children's mouths.
Exactly, and also obviously relevant to things like YouTube. People are blocking the ads on YouTube. The interesting thing was this survey also had the stat that over a half of the people surveyed didn't realise that when they accessed free content online, the ads were paying for the content. Who are these people?
What did they think it was there for?
Who didn't put the two together? Oh, they just have ads here because, oh, we all like to have a look at an advert. So an interesting bit of research.
Topspin co-founder Shamal Ranashinghe has joined Pandora.
So one of the founders of Topspin, the direct-to-fan platform. Of course, another person who used to run Topspin, Ian Rogers, is now off basically running Apple Music. So it's interesting that his former colleague has gone off to join Pandora. And his job is basically to try and placate all of those angry artists and labels who hate Pandora because of the royalties that they do or do not pay. They pay royalties, they just don't pay enough in the eyes of the labels and artists. They're going to go to the artists and labels and say, look, data, promotional platforms, like us. And Shamal, who is a popular character in sort of the music and the tech community, has been given the job of trying to placate everybody. It's a challenging post. I wish him luck.
And talking of challenging things, this is quite a long thing on our list. Is almost a whole story.
Oh, so Katy Perry. You're not saying the story is a challenge. You're saying you reading out this bullet point's a challenge.
I'm saying everything is a challenge. It's also very hot in here. Katy Perry is reportedly trying to buy an old convent from the Los Angeles Archdiocese of the Catholic Church, but the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary have already sold it to restaurateur Dana Hollister. That seems like the full explanation there, but do you want to add anything?
But that is most of the story, isn't it? So Katy Perry's seemingly caught up, and it's really nothing to do with Katy Perry. It's the fact that the church and the nuns who used to live in this convent can't agree on who owns it and who has the right to sell it, but it's pop
music news.
So
they've both sold it.
They've both sold it, and it classifies as pop news because rumour has it, this has not been confirmed by anybody, but rumour has it that the Catholic Church, the sort of the bureaucracy, are trying to sell it to Katy Perry. So that is why that is definitely music news.
Okay, then. Well, with that covered, let's move on to the last story. And with the new Amy Winehouse documentary out this week, today, if you're listening to this podcast as it goes out, you probably all waiting for the Cash In Rarities album featuring demos of her third album, which obviously was never released because she was still recording it when she died in 2011. But you're not going to hear that album, so stop hoping for it. Why are they not going to hear it?
There will be no more Amy Winehouse releases because the CEO of Universal Music UK, that being David Joseph, has sworn that he will not allow any more, you know, offcuts and little bits of Amy Winehouse to be released because he doesn't think that's the right thing to do. And he's so adamant of that, he claims he's destroyed all of the recordings that were never released. So this is what, I mean, there's been a number of interviews with people who work, particularly at Universal, who worked with Amy as this is coming out. It's sort of quite a bit of spotlight has been on this film in the sort of the music press this week. And that was one of the more interesting quotes that came out of those interviews. And you approve of this, don't you?
Good on him. I mean, it seems like, I mean, obviously posthumous albums are a big money. Well, I don't know about a big money spinner, but there are a lot of them. I did some looking around to check. There's you know, an artist, particularly if an artist dies sort of in their prime, as Amy Winehouse did, as you know, lots of people have, for years after their death, there will be, you know, the archives will be plundered for music they recorded before they died, and it will come out, and it's probably, you know, quite often it's stuff that they probably weren't happy with or wasn't finished, or they, you know, they just decided they, you know, there was a reason it come out.
Yeah, because it's one thing to do a compilation of rarities, you know, so B-sides or maybe radio sessions or maybe even some live recordings. But often what this is that when artists go into the studio, and I think some artists are more prone to this than others, they try out lots of things, they jam stuff, they try out a few lines. But actually, had they still been alive, they would never have released any of that stuff. You know, out of all of that came the 10 tracks that they were happy for people to have, and all that other stuff they would rather everybody forget about, but they're no longer here to say so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the big artist in recent years who's died is Michael Jackson, and there have already been two posthumous Michael Jackson albums, Michael and Escape, where basically they've got other producers and musicians to finish off tracks that were lying around, which obviously some people have. So they've always got quotes from these producers saying, "Oh, it's so great to be able to work on this music. Michael's so great." Although Will I Am was the one person when the first one came out. Came out and said that, you know, Michael Jackson was a perfectionist and, you know, he didn't want things released that weren't finished, and this is not what he'd want to happen.
So look at that. That's Andy Malt and Will I Am in agreement on something there.
It doesn't happen.
Who'd have thought it?
But I mean, obviously, and then I've been the big one, obviously, the one that always comes up is Tupac. I did have a quick look around. Tupac, he released four albums while he was alive. He's released seven since he died, as well as 10 compilations, two live albums and two remix albums. So that's pretty good going. Jeff Buckley as well has released a lot of compilations of demos and outtakes, various live albums and singles and EPs. Jimi Hendrix is the big one because, oh my God, he obviously, like you're saying, an artist who tried out a lot of stuff in the studio. So there's a big archive of unfinished stuff to go through. So he's released 12 posthumous albums, 24 live albums, 23 compilations, 20 EPs, 22 singles, various releases with other acts when he was a session musician and played with other bands, and those come up quite regularly.
Where they release those and he's just like doing a little bit at the back, but it's always sort of like, you know, in really big writing, it's with Jimi Hendrix. It's like, yeah,
well, there was one, I can't remember who the main artist was, but there was one, it was big artist and Jimi Hendrix. And then apparently the only involvement Jimi Hendrix had in this album was that his name is in the title. He wasn't on it at all.
But I suppose it's interesting because, I mean, we can accuse labels or maybe even the estate. Obviously, the Michael Jackson estate is very involved in those releases that you mentioned. We can accuse these people of cashing in, but then they might say, but the fans want it. And you know, why not let the fans have access to this stuff? And it sort of gives you a little insight into artists that we loved and who are
yes,
no longer
Yes, I mean,
with
it's
us.
Worth pointing out that there is one Amy Winehouse posthumous outtakes and demos compilation.
Some of which was because obviously she was working on a long awaited third album when she
yes.
died. So a big chunk of it was what she'd been recording for the album that never was.
Yes, and that was, I mean, that was it was, and it was it was the producer who she was working with, not Mark Ronson, the other producer she generally worked with, whose name was just gone out of my head. And I'm going to plead being on holiday.
Yeah,
again.
You're in France.
But you know, he put that together and said that, you know, it was music that they'd been working on, and she would have been happy, perfectly happy for this to come out. But it, I mean, it always does seem a little bit. I mean, that one also that came out quite quickly after her death, as far as I remember. It always does seem a little bit unseemly, even though obviously quite a lot of these things are done. With the blessing of these stuff, like the Michael Jackson albums, the Jeff Buckley albums, and the not all of the Jimi Hendrix albums, because there've been so many of them, but a lot of them are put out with the blessing and the involvement of their estates.
Yes, and the children, the family, and whatever. But on this occasion, that you, Will.i.am, and David Joseph from Universal are of one mind that stop releasing that's, dead people's music.
I don't think that's a sentence you're ever going to say out loud again.
So there you go. But I've not seen the Amy film. He's not seen it because he's been in France and they don't have films in France. But it does look like it's, you know, it's a really sort of interesting and emotional film. Obviously, the
quite controversial.
Her father's not very happy with it, is it? In the way that sort of some of the relationships are portrayed in the film. But whatever you think about it, I think it is definitely worth checking out. Maybe I will check it out before the next podcast and tell you about it. But I'm not promising that, so don't hold me to it.
Well, speaking of the next podcast, that will be the next thing you hear from us, because we've come to an end here. Next week we'll both be in the studio again.
Well, yeah, I've said that. Are you not trying to drive back via Calais? So
no, I'm not coming back via Calais.
Oh, are you not? So you're not going to be caught up in the ferry strike. So you will be here in a week's time.
I've planned wisely by going for the cheapest option, turned out to be
the sensible one
because there's no strikes.
So Andy Mott will be here next week. I'm not planning on going anywhere, so we'll both be in the same room for next week's podcast. But hey, Andy, do that stuff you do at the end of the podcast.
Okay. So while you wait for us to return, while you wait to see if maybe there will be strikes, let's put a bit of drama in it. Maybe all of the ferries will, maybe my ferry will sink. Who knows? But while you wait to see if that happens, see if next week is some memorial podcast to me, why don't you subscribe to it? Wherever you're listening to it now, hit a subscribe button or go somewhere else, subscribe to it there, review it. Rate it on iTunes. That is a big help. Follow us on Twitter at CMU and on Facebook if you search Complete Music Update. This is the CMU podcast. It is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It is produced by Matt Petey. And for more information on all things CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.